Good morning. And now from the horse herself. Living for God. When your mail is delivered, I wonder how you react. No doubt irritation at the amount of junk mail, maybe dread of the bills. But is there a lift of your hearts when you see a personal letter? I'm a big fan of WhatsApp and email for ease of communication. But I do miss the thrill of a letter I receive that I can keep and treasure. Why is that? Because they reveal so much about the sender. Their characters and qualities are there for the discerning reader. Usually a bit more care has gone into the composition than a quickly dashed off email, and it shows. For that reason, in preparation for this talk, I reread the accounts of Peter's life in the Gospels. There I found that his life's experiences had bled into the letter we've been studying for the past 5 weeks. Peter was the first disciple called by Jesus. A fisherman by trade, when he received the invitation, he immediately left his boat and followed Jesus. This shows that he was impulsive but discerning. He watched Jesus heal, teach, and was not afraid to ask him to explain what he meant. He attempted to walk on water. He was the first to declare that Jesus was the Son of God, and Jesus said that that was the rock on which the church would be built. He gets angry with Jesus when he says he's going to die, and when Jesus predicts that Peter will deny him, he says, "That will never happen." He's taken by Jesus up a mountain to witness the transfiguration, taken by Jesus to Gethsemane to pray. And when the soldiers come to arrest Jesus, he cuts off the servant's ear, but he then follows the arresting party at a distance, and we have no record of what the rest did. He's accused of being Jesus' disciple by a servant girl who denies him 3 times, just as Jesus said he would. And when the cock crows, he cries bitterly. He visits the empty tomb after the resurrection, and he encounters Jesus when fishing, and Jesus restores him fully. So this is written by Peter, the disciple who was impulsive, insightful, and quick to recognize the divinity of Christ. His energy and dynamism suffuse his writing. He was a man of action. What kind of writer was he? As you would expect, he's what I would call a strong writer. He uses active verbs, nouns with very descriptive adjectives, and there are exclamation marks for emphasis. The style is dynamic, speedy, sweeping us along with his directives and encouragement. It's persuasive, giving reasons for the advice, using therefore, for, since, so then, especially when the verb which follows is in the command form. Expressive similes or word pictures feature, such as like living stones, like newborn babes crave pure spiritual milk, and like sheep going astray, which reveal a tender side. The devil prowls around like a roaring lion. Clothe yourself with humility. These images bring a lovely colour and expressiveness to his writing. He quotes freely from the Old Testament, bringing that authority as backing for his desire that we will be the kind of people that he's trying to convince us to be. He's very logical and reasoned. In our passage, he says, "Therefore be clear-minded and self-controlled, so that you can pray." He's affectionate, describing them as dear friends. The letter is jam-packed with no padding or waffle, and it's been a big ask to cover it all in 6 weeks. And today our remit is 1.5 chapters, so we'd better get cracking. My aim today is twofold: one, to encourage us all in our Christian journey, and two, to challenge us to live a fully authentic, dedicated life of mature service for God. I have 3 sections taken from the allotted passage and hope you follow and remember and put into practice what Peter is suggesting. The talk has 3 main points and 2 items of homework. Point 1, and it comes from 1 Peter 4, verses 8 to 11. Above all, love each other deeply, because love covers over a multitude of sins. Offer hospitality to one another without grumbling. Each of you should use whatever gift you've received to serve others as faithful stewards of God's grace in its various forms. If anyone speaks, they should do so as one who speaks the very words of God. If anyone serves, they should do so with the strength God provides, so that in all things God may be praised through Jesus Christ. Point one, love expressed in service. The message here is very clear. You have been given gifts. Use them in the service of others. For many of you, that's true in your chosen career. You're already in a job which uses these. Great. In work, give your energy to being a faithful and conscientious employee. It's fantastic that so many in church are in jobs which help others and are motivated by factors other than merely making a lot of money for themselves. We're aware that a lot of families have two parents working, have children, and a minefield to navigate in helping them grow into healthy, caring adults in today's complex world. Yet you still find time to share your skills and expertise in the service of the church, in one of the 5 million committees, or on a Sunday to do some of the myriad tasks required to run the service. We do not take you for granted, and let us know if there are ways that we can help and support you. So here's your homework. First of all, I would like you, when you go home, to write down a list of your skills. I love being in this church surrounded by so many talented people. What riches we enjoy. But one of the problems is that we're inclined to compare ourselves unfavorably because we can't preach like Dick, or sing like Adrian, or paint like one of the many artists. But we do overlook the skills we do have, and we don't notice the soft skills we may possess, like the ability to really listen over coffee when someone tells you about a problem they're struggling with, and then remember to ask them about it the following week. Or at the welcome desk, to really look the arrivals in the eye and smile as if your coming had just made their day. Then your professional skills can be transferred. We have a lot of retired folk in our church. Look at the list of all your skills. Ask a friend or partner to do the same about you. How can you use these gifts, probably honed over a lifetime's career, in the service of your brothers and sisters in church? Here I'm thinking about Janet bearing down on folk in the coffee cabin with her syringe in hand, ready to remove the wax in their ears to their delight and her evident satisfaction. This example is terribly unsubtle, but hopefully memorable. Lots of our accountants spend their retirement doing the books for charities or helping old folk with their financial problems. Are the skills you have rusting away because you've not found some way of making them useful in church? Equally, do you have talents you did not use while working because you were too busy, which you could now develop and hone? It's too easy to get stuck in a rut. Love for each other demands that we serve one another. Our talents are to be used and not buried or hoarded. The problem is the nature of habit, which keeps us static and we make no progress. We have a clock which has hung in the same place in our kitchen for over 32 years. When it stopped working, I took it in to be repaired. Then 5 million times a day, I continued to look for the time where the clock should have been. It didn't matter that I was the one who took the clock away, that I wear a watch, and that there was another clock on the cooker. I still looked at the wall. We're all guilty of getting in a rut if we're not careful. And the longer we live, the more fully and implacably we incarnate ourselves. I watch with great interest a news item on Scottish TV about the life expectancy of residents in Scotland. It was making suggestions as how we could improve our health. My ears pricked up when cycling was mentioned, and we were shown a man on a bike. He was 71 and still upright. Can you imagine that? And he was kept young by cycling. Then the camera pulled back and we were given a panoramic view. There he was, sitting in a buggy with someone else doing all the pedalling. Of course, I'm very happy about his mental health engaging with folks, but how much was he missing? I recognise the location as near the Falkirk Wheel, and I couldn't help thinking that to the west is Balloch and to the east is Edinburgh, all on cycle paths. What adventures he could have. Are we guilty of freewheeling, trundling along on others' efforts? Is our life full of time torn off unused in that chilling Larkin phrase so typical of what he called verbal photography? We all go through difficult and painful experiences. Christian fellowship means we will be supported through these times. We have a pastoral team which is well set up to provide practical, emotional and spiritual assistance. We all need carried sometimes. But the problem is that if we stay in that cosy place being tended to, we never reach our own potential. The challenge of the passage is to use our gifts in the service of others, not to be pampered and served by others in the normal course of our lives. Stop freewheeling to milk the cycling metaphor and pursue Christian maturity. Challenge number two. If you notice someone going the extra mile, why not write an encouraging email or even a card? It can become very wearisome and discouraging if you're stretched and worn out, and the fact that someone notices can make a difference. It doesn't need to be mushy and sentimental, just some indication that you've noticed the efforts made. Here's a draft example of something you could write in poetic form. It describes a day at Summerfield when volunteers from church made some essential repairs. The paint-splattered helpers did their level best. Made a right pollock of it, they freely confessed. Douglas watched and worked as from a high tower. Janet's flowers bloomed in rich, vibrant colour. Jim was sawing and screwing a box for the tap. Maureen's poster showed all the efforts of Cap. Elspeth brought the soup and the pieces for lunch, voted best contribution by the fast wilting bunch. Volunteers all giving time and their skill, putting love into action, doing God's will. May I be forgiven? I used to be paid to teach poetry. The second point comes from 1 Peter 4, verses 12 to 14. Dear friends, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal that has come on you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice in as much as you participate in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. If you are insulted because of the name of Christ, you are blessed, for the spirit of glory and of God rests on you. And this section is dealing with Christians and suffering, or what I'm calling defining moments. Peter spends a lot of time dealing with suffering as a Christian. He takes it for granted that we will undergo trials. The Christian organization Open Doors supports Christians who are imprisoned and suffer for their faith. You may be a supporter. One of the staggering statistics on the slide is that almost 6,000 Christians were killed for their faith last year. There are Christian organisations which seek to rescue trafficked women, and it's not an exaggeration to say they risk their own lives in the process. And the slavery described by Maima and Neil is not confined to history. This may be an issue which motivates you to get involved. However, I would like to make this relevant to us all, and not just to those in prison for their faith. I hope it's not stretching the meaning of the passage to extend the application to those times in our lives when we're challenged about our faith, for we all have opportunities to identify as Christians and to stand up for what we believe to be right. Call it our defining moments, if you will. Peter had his defining moment and failed. All his life, he would look back on his denials and shudder, even though he knew he'd been forgiven. When later trials came, he did not fail. We all have testing times, and we look back with deep regret at the clotted darkness of our hearts, which led to us making wrong choices or saying what should never have crossed our lips or of being silent when we should have spoken. Of course, we know that ultimately love wins, but we wish we hadn't blown it when our testing time came. Our trials may have been already or still to come. Peter says from bitter experience, be ready. Ian and I recently visited the Corrie Ten Boom House in Harlem, where the Ten Boom family sheltered Jews and others who opposed the Nazi regime in their home, providing a hiding place till they could get to safety. They paid for this as some died and others spent time in concentration camps. But when the testing time came, they could stand in the trial. They proved themselves worthy. When the army swept into Holland, the Ten Boom family were not at risk. They could have lived their lives in safety, but they believed their Christian duty was to protect and save the Jewish people targeted by the Nazis, and the consequences for them were very severe indeed. Their lives were changed forever. Two family members died in concentration camps. David Smith's book, Stumbling Towards Zion, contains the following somewhat alarming piece. The Holocaust tells a depressing story of widespread, though never total, capitulation by churches and Christian leaders to the insidious attractions of racial ideology and of the habitual silence or inaction of many Christians in the face of observed atrocities. What is disturbing is the seeming impotence of their faith to resist the destructive power of racial hatred. We all have defining moments in our lives when we'll have the opportunity to do the right thing. The Ten Boom family were well prepared. The architect had devised and built a false wall in a bedroom and arranged the access through the bottom shelf in a cupboard. They were then ready to act with split-second speed when the knock on the door came and were able to assist those seeking refuge to safety. In order for us to stand when our defining moment comes, we have to prepare in advance to have the kind of relationship with Christ, which means our courage does not fail. A few weeks ago, Alison spoke of the highlight of her job being that she got to work with the bravest people who'd put themselves on the line. And my third point comes from 1 Peter 5, verse 7. Cast all your anxiety on him, for he cares for you. This is the final point I wish to make, and it's very timely as the problem of worry and care is at epidemic proportions today. Let me be clear. Here, I'm not dealing with the issue of clinical depression, which requires expert medical intervention. I'm talking about the niggling anxiety which can pervade our everyday life experience and rob us of our joy. Look again at the text. Cast all your care on God, for he cares for you. I'm going to illustrate this by being very personal and talking about myself. I apologize for that. I use myself as an example, not because what I'm going to talk about was the worst thing that ever happened to me, but because I can talk about it without betraying anyone's confidence. Many years ago, I found a lump, and I did what everyone should do when faced with a worry. First of all, do what you can to sort out the situation. Worry plus action can be a very powerful combination. Take appropriate action to fix the problem as far as it is in your power. In this case, I reported to my GP. Then my referral form got lost, and it took 5 weeks before a biopsy was taken as my referral forms were mislead. So I pursued it. I phoned them up. I did not sit back and say, don't worry about this, God will fix it. But I didn't tell anybody else about it, as there was no point in worrying them. My mantra was, it's not time to worry yet. How is that possible? For 5 weeks, I had an unpleasant secret that would take the shine from others' days. The probability was that the lump was not cancerous, so why share the news? I was not pretending. I was not frightened. I was not worried. No one spotted anything wrong. Not even my mum, who, when she became blind, could spot when there was something wrong with you by the tone of your voice. I had cast my care on God, and I could eat, sleep, and live a normal life. Why? Cast all your care on him, for he cares for you. Look at this sentence. Cast is an active verb and implies throwing something far away from you, not laying down a burden temporarily to pick it back up again 5 minutes later when you've got your breath back. It means consciously throwing it far away from you onto God, who will take charge. Look at the second half of that sentence. Why will God do that? Because he loves you. You can cast all your care on him because he cares for you. It is possible to live a life without being crippled by fear and anxiety. You can throw it away and live because God is carrying that burden for you. Of course, I know that personality is a significant factor here, but the promise is given to all. 3. Share your worries with praying friends. When the biopsy proved positive and I knew I had cancer, believe me, I told others. I had family and lots of friends and a church who prayed for me. The postman used to stagger under the weight of cars delivered, which promised prayer and love. I can't tell you how much that buoyed me up and gave me strength. Throughout the treatment, I was able to eat, sleep, interact normally with people, and live my life unburdened by anxiety or worry. Why? I had cast my care on God, knowing he cared for me. I'm by no means unique in this church with that situation. There are others here who can testify to a similar story. God's care for us means he can carry our burdens and leave us so much lighter. So, in conclusion, we have 3 messages for today. 1, love one another and express it in service. 2, be ready for the testing times. 3, do not be anxious. God cares for you. This is our study of 1 Peter. His themes are joy and hope and love. Imagine getting a letter with that message through your letterbox. My friends, over the last 6 weeks, you just did. Can you put your hand up, please, if you've read any Philip Yancey books? Right. Could you keep your hand up if you've read the latest? You will know his themes are the problem of suffering for Christians who believe in a God of love. The other theme is grace. Philip has written a memoir, and it quickly becomes clear why his entire writing life has been devoted to these themes. This is what Philip says. The title of my memoir comes from a phrase by St. Augustine, who said he could not look at the sun directly, but looked on where the light fell, until he could follow these rays back up to the sun. I too could not look at the sun directly. I'd been scorched by a strict religious environment that misrepresented God as a kind of bully, enforcing rules of behavior with a scowl. I tell of 3 places where the light fell for me: the beauties of nature, classical music, and romantic love. As I experienced the softer side of God, especially in what I learned from Jesus, I wanted at last to know the one responsible for so much goodness. G.K. Chesterton used to say, the worst moment for an atheist is when he feels a deep sense of gratitude and has no one to thank. Philip says, that's the condition in which I found myself until God found me. I loaned my copy of the book to a friend who was so disturbed by what it provoked in him, he asked to come and talk about it with me. He wondered if the version of Christianity proclaimed by Philip Yancey's church deserved the name, and indeed he went beyond that. I told him that for me, where the light falls is on you. There are people in this church who spend their lives unsparingly in the service of others, of those inside the church needing the support we discussed earlier, and of a broken and needy world. Instead of enjoying an easy and luxurious life attending only to their own wishes, they devote their lives in the service of others. People like that influence us all. I was recently speaking with a Chinese girl who was describing a Christian woman she'd met in the very few months that she spent in Scotland, and she said, there is a light comes from her. Isn't that fantastic? Don't you wish that could be said of you? The end result is joy and the knowledge that the best is yet to come. May the road we have to walk with its twists, joys and sorrows, a road we might never have chosen, become nevertheless a highway which leads unerringly to God.